believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Moonshot EDU Show. I'm Bernard Bull, your host. And this is a third episode in a series that I'm doing on launching new schools and on small schools, micro schools. Today, in this interview, I have what I consider to be a luminary of education. A number of years ago, maybe it was a year or two ago, I wrote an article about education as poetry. Today, so many people talk about the science of education and the science of learning. And I wrote this article suggesting that maybe the metaphor of poetry is something that we don't want to lose, something that's incredibly powerful, something that takes us to the heart and the essence of teaching and learning and what makes education human. And my guest today embodies that. He's embodied it for years in his consulting, in his work, in a school that he's founded. So this is Stuart Grauer, who's founder of the Grauer School. He's author of two books, one book called Real Teachers, Two True Stories of Renegade Educators, and then a more recent book called Fearless Teaching, Collected Stories. And this most recent book, Fearless Teaching, it's really this incredible tribute to the essence of great teaching and learning and the essence of education. So I'm so excited to share this interview with you. I thoroughly enjoyed this interview. In fact, I'm excited to get out to the Grauer School and hopefully get a chance to spend a little more time with Stuart and the other people there and the students and to learn about the school. This is one school that I hope to profile in a future book on small schools, on micro schools and their power and their potential in the contemporary education landscape. So I'm just going to pause there and let you listen to the interview. I know that you're going to find some incredible stuff here. We learn about Stuart's story, his path that led him to become founder of this school. We dive into a few pieces of the recent book, Fearless Teaching. And at the end, please stick around to the end, because this is probably the best conclusion to any interview that I've ever done. I didn't know that it was going to happen. It wasn't planned. But Stuart offers to recite a little poem that sort of sums up a lot of what he was talking about in the interview. It's really incredible. Look forward to sharing it with you now. As usual, after the interview, I'll come back on with a few concluding thoughts. Here we go. Stuart, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Bernard.
Well, as we get started, I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about your own background. How did you get to where you are today?
I think one of my friends, Tony Smith, who unfortunately recently died, a McKinsey and leadership and consultant nationwide, worldwide, covered me in a chapter of a book he wrote called Leadership and Luck. And I think a large part of where I got where I am today is because I won a football pool lottery. I stopped into a bar years ago, and I was a little bit, not content, but it wasn't that I was discontent. It was that at the several schools I had worked in early in my career, I just never really captured that sense of belonging that I was looking for. When, you know, they say find your people, and I really hadn't. And I somehow knew that if I traveled far, I would find them. And I realized that I wanted to work in Switzerland. I just pointed that out. I was passionate about skiing. I was passionate about the European culture. I was a teacher of European culture studies. And I wandered into a bar, the Jaunting Car Pub in Manhasset, Long Island. And a friend of mine was bartending there and asked me to join the football pool. And I put down $10 on it, and I didn't even know who was playing. But a couple of days later, she called me up and said, "Stuart, you won. Here's your money." And so I, without thinking about it, immediately bought a ticket to Switzerland, rented a car, and plotted out all the best ski areas to circumnavigate the country. But everywhere I went, the nearest ski area always had an independent international school nearby. So I interviewed, ostensibly to be touring the country looking at schools. And in the International School of Bern, I met a wonderful headmaster. We developed a correspondence, and I launched my international school career. There, I started meeting my people, including people who had founded schools, and that was the mind-blowing, mind-opening experience for me to know that this could be done.
Yeah. Now you've taught in a number of different schools over the years, correct?
Yes. Before founding the Grauer School, I had worked at seven different schools, and I was a tenured public school teacher. I was taught at several different independent private schools, international, of course, and even taught at two different schools of education in San Diego as a graduate school professor.
It's interesting that you started in the international education world. I've always been so inspired by what's happening in international schools, especially in Asia. I've had a chance to tour and to learn about some of the fascinating things happening. I consider them to be some of the best teachers I've ever seen.
I think what really inspired me over there was there's a different set of presumptions about what a teacher is. You know, they're maestros, they're meisters, they're, you know, I think they're steeped in an older tradition, whereas in the United States, naturally in some European countries too, but the whole thing has become very bureaucratized, and we're all trying to turn teachers into downloaders of curriculum, into rankable non-humans, you know. So back then Europe was holding on to the Meister vision of what a teacher could be. Actually, I now have robust correspondence with educators all over Europe, and they're feeling devastated by some of the same bigness that's plaguing United States schools. But interestingly, you know, to that note, when I first founded the Grauer School, I had help with professors from University of California at San Diego and United States International University, and some really good educators local to San Diego. And we had a great conversation about what to call these people who were going to teach the kids, because we thought wasn't sure whether the name teacher had been co-opted. And we went through all the things, facilitator and mentor and coach and on and on. I'm sure all of your listeners can think of their own. But after deep discussion, we finally arrived at the one that was the most beautiful, most steeped in gorgeous traditions, and it was teacher. And we just have to reclaim that word, because it is a noble profession, and we don't want to lose that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And since you brought up the school, let's go ahead and dive into that part of your journey in education. Can you tell a little bit of the story of how you decided to launch a school, and maybe what some of those formative influences were?
Oh, sure. I mean, aside from seven different schools and recent graduation from the University of San Diego doctoral program in transformational leadership, I was living and working in the North County of San Diego, and a park was being built nearby, and they couldn't get the thing passed because land use and development in San Diego is hot. And, you know, if an acre changes hands in San Diego, it's like war. So they were proposing a park, and they couldn't get it passed. And so finally the city said, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to remove the basketball courts and the skate ramp, and we're not going to do anything in this park that might even remotely appeal to teenagers, and then the park will be okay. And then simultaneously, there was a beautiful big park, Disneyland theme park type thing called Legoland, being developed right nearby at the same time. And they were also having a terrible time developing beautiful North County San Diego acreage. And they made the same promise. They said, finally, at the Zoning Planning Commission, they said, and make sure we're not going to have any rides or attractions that'll appeal to teenagers. And I had been already working in the schools, in hanging around teenagers for 17 years at six different schools before founding Grauer. And I knew that, you know, they were waiting in line to ask their teachers a question. I knew a lot of grown-ups are kind of scared of them or leery of them. They don't find them approachable. I know a lot of them are coming of age around 14 or 15 and are, you know, programmed for something like 40,000 years now to find independent mentors, to leave, to, you know, to emerge as individuals. And they didn't have anybody in the large schools. And so I wanted to found a school where kids could have true mentors and have a real voice. So I think that's, it's all started with some parks.
and this is not your typical vanilla school. You guys have some really wonderfully unique or distinct attributes. Can you, for those who aren't familiar with the school, can you just talk us through what's the vision for the school? What's a day in the life or a week in the life or a semester in the life of a student at the school?
Great question, Bernard. The Grauer School is a secondary or grade 7 through 12 private independent school. It's a public charity. It has board governance. It has larger visions as well. We have a 2-acre habitat corridor, and we do innovative educational work to spread all over the world, in addition to developing our school. The school's, of course, the main order of business there. It is, some people might call it progressive. I don't know whether that's so when you take a look at the whole history of the school. You know, history, when you're involved in social change, you have to have a larger sense of history. And I know that in many respects, the Grauer School is very traditional. There are Socratic teachers. We use Montessori methodology in allowing kids to explore. We use Waldorf methodology to integrate arts across the curriculum and lots of nature in pretty much every class. And we use University of California A through G standards for college entry. So balancing all of these progressive and traditional trends, whether it's Dewey or Socrates or Albert Einstein, it's like driving a race car. It's the greatest balancing act in the world, and I love it. But one of the things that makes us special that I want to appeal to you and to your readers is the unique way we focus on self-directed education. One of the main purposes of the Grauer School is to be a liberating environment rather than a controlling environment. And yet, as I've already said, we have this gigantic balancing act. We have the, you know, intense parents who demand they get their kids into college. And we also live in a community that, you know, has reasonable expectations. They know that college and a certain track is a safe way into adulthood. And so we can't change everybody's presumptions. So in this balancing act, giving a college preparatory curriculum, what we're doing almost subversively sometimes is looking for what I like to call pockets of democracy. And even though we're giving college preparatory courses, we're constantly on search, looking for ways to give kids more voices and choices, as we like to say right now. For instance, bells are controlling. You're right in the middle of a class, in the middle of a thought, and suddenly you get this grinding bell sound that shuts you off as though artificially whatever you're thinking or doing is coming to an end from on high. And even though we do have block periods at the Grauer School and lots of latitude for trips and we have a program, a computer program that I actually wrote called Zen Bells. And what happens is between periods is a soft tinkling might come on, such as ocean waves or Baroque music or a little soft jazz, very just above audible level. And you don't see doors bursting open at the Grauer School. You just kind of see people drifting from one room to another as the transitions occur. But Bernard, let that just be a metaphor, because there are 100 ways that we're looking for pockets of democracy. And I list just two or three of them for starters?
That would be wonderful.
Okay, so let's just say that in most schools you have an honor roll, but it's determined a priori by the authorities what it means to get on the honor roll. Not so at Grauer. At Grauer School, we ask every student in every class what grade they think they'd like to achieve. And we record that, and this is another program I've been developing with a programmer for many years now. And we set their own mastery learning level. So to get at the honor roll at Grauer School, you meet or exceed the standards you've set for yourself. Now, using a mastery learning methodology, what we do is a flag goes up, so to speak, in any subject where, if you're a student, you get any grade that is below your mastery learning level. And that means that you rework that and hand it in again. So our teachers are becoming used to this beautiful iterative process. Just like in the same way, Bernard, when you write a paper, it's going to be reviewed by all of your editors and all of your co-writers. You know, when I write a speech, all of my handlers are reading it 5 times. That's the same way it is to present. And that's where, really, I would say at least half or most of the learning is sometimes in this iterative process that allows teachers to really be teachers, so that the students, if they don't master something, why go on to the next thing, which is the basic concept of mastery learning. In fact, you can, rather than give AP classes, which we consider to be about a mile wide and a half inch deep, and are basically a race to the finish where you're judged and the teacher is too by a single score, we refuse to give them. And it's cost us dearly, but we'll never give them until AP changes radically anyway. And we give honors classes. And the honors classes are an agreement between the teacher and the student, where the student says, I have a passion in this area, whether it's physics or American literature. I'm going to pursue some extra enriched materials, and we'll meet, say, at lunch once a week, and we're going to go over these projects. If you complete them, then you're an honor student. That's really honorable. So that's just a few things. Oh, another interesting thing is that even though we have regular classes and regular teachers every day, all day, you can do almost anything you want at the Grauer School if you petition for it. So if you want a new class, if you want a new club, if you want to have an activity or a dance, if you want to, our kids even petition to have a senior ditch day. That was something I love. And they also created a petition to do the March 14th walkout. And our school, even though, you know, privately, I was very strongly in favor of that, that walkout. And I'm incredibly appalled at the corruption behind our lack of proper gun control in this country. But I wasn't saying that. All I was saying is I want our students to be able to have a voice. And here's what's happening in our schools. And if you'd like to do something about it, then you may petition. And they did. And they had a successful – they petitioned for their walkout. And they had it. I went along with them. Took photographs. Now, the only thing, other thing I want to say about the petition program at Grauer is that it's very rigorous. Our students are even kind of joke around about how much rejection they face. When you turn in a petition at Grauer, you're accustomed to getting it knocked back again and again and again, and typically doing around 5 drafts, because our kids learn that these petitions in any organization or institution are not going to succeed unless you persevere. And so what we're finding is that our kids at colleges are not just joining clubs and activities, but they're actually creating them through petition process that they learn. And that's also really one of my favorite pockets of democracy at Grauer.
I love that phrase, pockets of democracy. We could probably talk about the school the entire time, but I also want to talk about your role as an author and your most recent book, Fearless Teaching,
yes.
where you take the readers on this really incredible journey of learning and what it looks like and teaching and what it looks like around the world. Can you tell us a little bit about the inspiration for that book? And it is kind of a unique format, too. So maybe if you can take the listeners through that as well.
Well, thank you. I'd be glad to. Fearless Teaching is 30 blog-length stories. My previous book, Real Teachers, I decided I was going to tell stories in the greatest depth and detail and richness of fabric and really expound on these things so that teachers and educational leaders could kind of just sink into these environments and feel what it was like to be an educator all over the world. And as you probably know, limited the readership to, you know, probably about 2,000 or 3,000 all over the world. Not very many people are willing to. People are having a lot of trouble not being distracted long enough to read a 30-page story. And reluctantly, I decided I was going to write Fearless Teacher, filled with 30 stories rather than just 10 of blog-length stories. And I've been really, really lucky. One of the things that the Grauer School has afforded me to do is to lead student and teacher groups all over the world. And as per our petition process at Grauer, that process isn't open only to students. It's open to teachers as well. And students or teachers year-round are petitioning to do their dream trips, and they're doing them. Every year we're just taking students and teachers all over the world based upon certain criteria. They have to be full immersion. They can't be tourists at all. They have, you know, like we went to a trip to Africa and visited 7 schools. Anyway, I've just been everywhere all over the world. Also, in addition to student trips, I've been fortunate to be invited by different groups, whether it was the Korean Ministry of Education or whether it was a small private school up in the Cascade Mountains. And, you know, people and groups have just started asking me to come up and either talk or consult at schools. I just love it. I never have charged anybody for anything, really like seeing liberating education spreading into schools and teacher groups. So anyway, I developed a lot of stories, Bernard, and they all have one simple theme, and that is, I'm calling it Fearless Teaching, but the real idea is, we have to hold fast to our ideals, not become bureaucrats, not judge our teaching experiences based upon rank and status and numbers, and develop these authentic learning experiences. So I've described authentic learning experiences that great educators all over the world are doing. It was an amazing opportunity. You know, they're in little schools in Africa. They're, some of them are formative experiences. One of my favorite stories is called The Moon in a Jar, which is the metaphor being catching fireflies in the forest behind my house growing up. Not realizing that I was trapping them, and then having at the age of 7 the land movers come in and take that whole forest out from behind my house and turning it into a shopping mall. And then for the next 2 or 3 or 4 years, not having any understanding why, as a small child, I was going back there and shoplifting little things and coming home with them, just as I had in the forest, until finally somebody gave me the wake-up call. I guess it was my mom. But I started to think that in a way, that's what we've done to natural learning experiences, that our kids are put in rows, that school is compulsory. And even remembering back, I was talking this weekend with a young lady from Arkansas, and she described her school, and she said it didn't have any windows. And I'm not sure if you're too young to remember that, but it was probably the 70s. All over the country, they built schoolhouses with no windows in the classrooms. And it still blows my mind that people would think that the role of education would be to be that controlling and that limiting in something that historically has been the most beautiful, liberating experience of all humankind. So I've trapped, not in a jar, but in a book, beautiful educators all over the world who are providing these types of liberating experiences. And some of the, quite a few of the stories are quite outlandish because when you're out there out of bounds, being toured around with hordes of tribesmen going hunting or Panamanian teachers picking up their students on a Ponga boat, you know, you are finding different types of experiences that still can inform our work right here in California and really work of folks like you all over the country.
Yeah, it really is a beautiful book. And the stories, for those who are listening, these are the kinds of stories that just deepen your sense of wonder about teaching and learning and really do sort of bring us back to the heart, the essence of what it means to be a teacher. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Bernard. I just want to say that the challenge, the prevailing kind of background assumption I was making was that we've entered an era of data-crazed learning, where everything has to be represented by data, and teachers are judged that way. And it was clearly causing some of the best and the brightest to leave the profession. And it's ruining the experience for a lot of kids who have other kinds, you know, broader kinds of intelligences. So it's not just a trivial thing. It's a great tragedy. And so I set out to write a book that showed educational principles that are so true that they're beyond proving, that you can't even, that they're more true than data, truer than things you can prove.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. So as we finish up here, I just have a few kind of questions, just bigger picture with your wealth of experience in education. And maybe you just mentioned the one that comes to mind for you. But as you look at the landscape, just the current landscape in education, what do you see as the most pressing challenges or problems for us to tackle?
Oh, my gosh, no question about it. The bigness as a disease that when we the smart money in education is not in teaching. It's in testing kids and providing them with technology and in convincing all the educational bureaucrats that if they buy all this technology, that their work is going to be done for them and that the teachers will be controllable. Bigness standardizes, bigness demoralizes, bigness dehumanizes. So getting back, not only in the schools, but in each of us as humans, getting back that humanity is by far the biggest challenge. Leaders have to be, I think there are two basic challenges for leaders right now. One of them is to keep your devotion. When you see somebody who is devoted to a cause, you know they're capable of leadership. But also, and staying that course. But in addition, I think we have to be willing to question our own self. Know that we're going to slip too, and that leadership is a constant spiritual search as well. And we need to be able to provide those spiritual searches for our followers and for our teachers rather than just train them. So I think the next era leadership skill is going to not just be providing the right training for teachers, but rather for honoring their great wisdom by having this beautiful skill of creating reflexive spaces for them so that they can be dreamers as well.
So what gives you hope in education today? What are some of the more promising possibilities that you've seen?
I think that I kind of have these days abandoned the idea that I can fix education or fix society or stop extinction or some of these things. And what gives me hope is that I have, that we still can create spaces and communities where where we can be with our people. And I hope this doesn't sound wrong, but even if we're all going down in burning flames, I'm going to go down with a few people I love. we can create those spaces and create those communities and be the kinds of role models that we need to be.
So everyone on the show gets the final question. It's the moonshot question. That's the name of the show, JFK's moonshot in the 60s. And I know some people treat a moonshot as sort of this wasteful, unrealistic dream, but that's not how I'm framing it. I'm framing it as a really incredibly challenging goal, but something that's achievable with the right effort and the right group of people kind of rallying around it. Do you have a moonshot for education?
I sure do, Bernard. I'm very busy launching my moonshot and have been for about 10 years now, and it's called the Small Schools Movement. When I'm ruler or shooting the moon, all of these monolithic schools are going to be broken down into smaller, manageable, authentic learning communities. So you take communities like Vermont that are being collapsed into consolidated schools. The locals are horrified, and I get letters every week from people in communities like that saying, what are we going to do? We can't take our kids to school anymore. The buses feel forbidding and unsafe to my kids. They're getting bused millions of miles a year. Our elders can't engage as volunteers in the school anymore. The local shopkeepers are losing our community. The school was the middle of our village, and we're losing our community because of consolidation. So I think with the consolidated schools that already exist, they can be broken down into smaller learning communities. I've even seen it done in Nanjing, China. They had one wing of a school as a English-speaking small school of about 150 kids, which is a perfect tribe size, the size of the Grauer School. We need to start talking about our school sizes in terms of the tribe size, such as the Grauer School's 200 teachers and students. That's the group size, not just the student count. We're all there together. But we can create schools within schools. We can stop school consolidation, and we can nurture school developers. Jerry Mintz over there at Alternative Educators Resource Organization has got a school starters class. Deb Meyer is involved in that as well. Both of them have endorsed my books. The Small Schools Movement that's the moonshot. I have been doing it for about 10 years. Sometimes people disdain it or laugh at it, but other times people love it. And I guess I'd like to finish that with a poem that I've memorized that has been guiding me on this moonshot for many, many years by William Stafford, called The Way It Is. And I hope I get it right, but there's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you're pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it's hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen. People get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread.
Can't think of a better way to end the show. Stuart, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Bernard.
Again, that was Stuart Grauer, founder of the Grauer School, author of Real Teachers, True Stories of Renegade Educators, and also author of Fearless Teaching, Collected Stories. Well, I told you that was going to be a good one, and it was, wasn't it? And wasn't that a pretty incredible end to the interview, as Stuart sort of summed up some of these key concepts or ideas or his vision in this poem? There's so many things we could reflect on for an interview like this, but there was obviously this one phrase that Stuart kept bringing us back to: pockets of democracy. And maybe that's something for us to think about. I mean, there's so much, and each of us will take away something different, what we need from an interview, from a conversation like this. But I'd love to think that that's one that maybe we'll all take away from this conversation. What are the pockets of democracy in our learning communities? Are there pockets of democracy? How can we create other ones? How can we create new ones? How can we invite the learners to join us in co-creating pockets of democracy? Because that's what we're trying to do here, right? And we're trying to prepare people for a full, rich life in a democracy, in a republic, in a place where their voice matters, where their choices make a difference and have implications for them and the people around them and their community and their world. So why wouldn't we have those pockets for people to experiment and explore and to learn and to develop in those ways? And Stuart gave us a wonderful vision for how that can happen in a school. So, that's all I have for you in this episode. This was the third in a series on micro schools and launching new schools. So I had a couple of interviews with authors of books who taught you how to start a new school. And this was one to give you sort of a compelling vision for someone who did it. And he did it in an incredibly powerful way, with an incredibly powerful and distinct vision for teaching and learning. And I'll certainly be bringing on others who are founders of schools. That's kind of a pattern in this podcast. We have founders of all sorts of things who are persistently on. But that's my three-part series that I'd plan to put together. I'd love to hear from you all and let me know what you thought of the episode or some of the most recent episodes. If you have some other ideas or tips or suggestions, I'm always excited to hear about them. If you have suggestions on people you think would be great to bring on the show, let me know. So that's all for now. I'll see you on the next episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.